So I have now started the recorder. Today is Tuesday, September 18th, 2012. This is George Cusis, graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports, as a part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project. I'm interviewing Larry Quested over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And Mr. Quested, again, I just wanted to thank you for your time and your willingness to share some of your memories. And if you could start with a bit of information about your background, where and when were you born, and what was your childhood like?
I was born in Livingston, Montana, and July 10th, 1943.
How did you kind of get your start in sports?
Well, it's a small town. Livingston is about 8,000 people. And just about everybody I knew, we did four sports. We played football in the fall, basketball in the winter, track in the spring, and baseball in the summer. And that's really all there was to do besides fish and hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, I participated in all four of those sports for my high school years, which was a four-year high school. And although the freshmen couldn't compete with the varsity, so you had a three or four-year school when they segregate it like that. But you just do what you can do depending on the time of the year.
Yeah.
So.
Now, what was the name of the high school that you were at?
Park County High School.
Park County High School.
Right.
And what drew you to track, or was that your favorite of the four?
Well, it would be the thing I had the most success at. Would have been probably how I got going. I mean, I certainly didn't start running when I was a sophomore in high school thinking I was going to go to the Olympics. I just wanted to beat somebody. And I guess when I started to run as a sophomore, the upperclassmen who thought they were pretty fast got a look at something that was maybe a little faster than they'd anticipated. I had 3 years of varsity track that I didn't lose a 100-yard dash or 220-yard dash in 3 years. And I had 2 years of hurdles, the same thing. I got second in my sophomore year in state running the low hurdles. So, you know, we won state 1 year as a team, and then the second year when I was a sophomore, there were only a couple of people that really won individual events, so we ended up in second place in the state with just myself and four other guys that ran a couple of the races and did a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody, you know, got gold medals.
Right.
So I have eight golds and one silver. Actually, I have more than that.
Yeah.
I forgot about it. I ran some relays, too. That we won.
Now, were you always drawn to the sprints and the short distance?
Yeah, I long jumped and high jumped.
Okay.
In addition to the sprints and the hurdles. But I was the best events for me were the short sprints.
Yeah.
I hated the 400.
Yeah.
That was just too much work.
Did you have any major influences at that time in sports or in athletics?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Just myself I had encouragement from my family, of course, because it wasn't as brutal as football. And I was enjoying a fair amount of success and notoriety for that.
Mm-hmm.
So
can you take us through that transition to college? Obviously, you ran track in college as well. Take us through that whole progression from high school to college.
Well, what happened my senior year in high school was, is I got invited to the Golden West track and field meet, which was the top high school track and field contestant or athletes from around the western part of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two guys that were, nationally ranked. They were the number one guy in the 100 and the number two in the 200. A guy named Forrest Beatty was 100. A guy by the what was his name? Oh, I forget his name. There were, anyway, but he was the 220-yard tied for the fastest time of the year. The records were all theirs and everything else. And I ran against him in the Golden Gate meet and beat them both. So there was some interest already by a number of schools for both different athletic scholarships, probably more football than track. But I got even, like I said, scholarship offers for both those sports. And then where I eventually went to school, which was Stanford, they offered me an academic scholarship. And that sounded pretty good to me, and that's really the reason I went there. I didn't realize the caliber of school at Stanford was, being from a little town in Montana. It didn't mean a whole lot to me. But Peyton Jordan meant a lot to me, because he did recruit me, and I really was in awe of the man. And so I went to Stanford.
Could you talk a little bit about your collegiate career thereafter? What was that experience like for you?
Well, I got a lot of publicity and a lot of notoriety in the Pac-10 or Pac-8, whatever it was at the time, and had, a great deal of success. Didn't win everything, but won more than my fair share. And I won the conference, and the first big meet I won was the NCAA. And I won the 100 meters and got second to Henry Carr in the 200 meters.
What year was this?
That would have been 1963.
Okay. So is that, you said sophomore? I can't remember now.
Yeah, I was a sophomore.
Okay.
Then. Yeah. I tell you, it's a kind of a side story to this whole thing, but there's a reason I was there for four years. Is I spent a year on the outside looking in for some practical joking that I got involved in. And got suspended.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was the year before Tokyo. So I had done pretty well at the Nationals that summer as well, and I traveled in 63 when I won the NCAA. I went from the NCAA to the AAU, and we had some difficulties there, but I got invited to travel to Russia, and we went there for what was called the Brothers Zamansky Memorial Meet, which was the Communist World Championships.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the first, it was a relationship thing with Peyton Jordan with the Gabriel Korobkov, who was the coach of the USSR team. And they extended an invitation for three athletes from Stanford to go to this meet. So the first international meet that I ran ever was in Moscow Stadium.
Wow.
100,000 plus fans and non-communist athletes. I had a very successful meet. I won both of the sprints, beating all the Communist World Champion sprinters. And I was given the athlete of the meet.
Was the political situation something that you thought about then as an athlete, or were you...
Yeah. That was right in the middle of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there was a lot of interest in that. And, you know, just little things that you remember. We represented ourselves. They had a parade of athletes, much like they do at Olympic Games. It's that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Wheel, who was a discus thrower, silver medalist in 64, I believe, and another guy by the name of Steve Courtright, who was a hurdler. The three of us represented the United States in the parade of athletes, and everybody dipped their flag. We had carried a big American flag, and Dave Wheel is a 6'9", 260-pound man.
Mm-hmm.
And he carried the American flag, and he was just about ready to dip it. And I got real close to him and said, "Don't you dare." And he didn't. So there were two flags that held up over a stadium full of flags of all the Communist World countries. Two flags standing tall and a whole bunch of dipped flags.
Very interesting.
But anyway, that was one. And then I made, for another month or so, I toured around and competed in, well... All this is coming back to me. I went to the World Games. We're in Helsinki, Finland, on that same summer. And I went and competed in those and won both the sprints and the World Games as well. So that leads me... I forgot about all that.
Now, just a quick follow-up. So when you were in Russia, did you have much contact with... any of the Soviet athletes?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah. I suspect we probably were being closely observed. But, no, we had the big dinner where they had us at, I forget who it was. It was one of the premiers or whatever they call themselves, the head of the government. Was that we had this big U-shaped table that probably had 40 to 60 people on each wing, and across the top were all the dignitaries and that kind of stuff. And we had the toast with them, and we had a real affair that night.
Mm-hmm.
We had relationships that lasted for a few years, you know, because you did make friends with them.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think it's it's been well received, I think, by lots of people that the athletics competition can melt a lot of cold ice that's between countries and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And the athletes, they compete, particularly in track and field. I suspect that maybe in some other sports too, but track and field, because it's competitive, but it's non-combative. you can be friends after, and I never was being much good at being very friendly before you competed. Afterwards, you could sit around and swap stories forever.
Sure. So moving forward now, you'd mentioned Helsinki. What kind of came in the years after that at Stanford?
Well, the next year was going to be 1964, so long ago that it doesn't sound real. Was Tokyo Olympics, and I got invited to go test the facilities at a world meet that they held in Tokyo in the fall before the Olympic Games were there to test the facilities and all that kind of stuff. So they had this big meet, and they invited us to Tokyo, and we toured several places in Japan competing, and I honestly don't remember what I did there.
Was
I didn't do as well, because I know I had put on a few pounds in the summertime. I weighed about 216 pounds, I recall weighing in and thinking, holy Toledo. I really hadn't been training that much, but we went to Tokyo anyway and evaluated the facilities and had a great time and ran some races.
Mm-hmm. Now, had you tried out for that 64 team?
Well, the Olympic trials came around in the spring of 64, and I was really probably running my very best in 64 that I ever ran. And I had a series, I pulled a hamstring at Mount San Antonio Relays and missed one of the qualifying meets for the Olympic trials, which was held in, I think it was on Randall's Island that year in New York. And combination of being injured and then I had in 100 meters I had an equipment failure that no one observed except coming out of starting blocks and the blocks broke loose.
Oh, wow.
And I did a face plant on a cinder track.
Wow.
Still got, it was either third or fourth, blood all over my shirt and my nose and whatnot, and no one saw that, and I got eliminated in 100 meters. And I don't know what happened in 200. I don't honestly remember what happened, but I didn't qualify for the team, which was really kind of heartbreaking, because I felt that I deserved it and had earned it, a chance to at least compete against the best of people. The guys that made the team, with the exception of Bob Hayes, he's the only one that I hadn't beaten.
Mm-hmm. Now, did that disappointment provide that extra motivation 4 years later? Because you came back fairly strong.
Yeah, it did, but it took a while. I was really kind of, my junior and senior years in college, I kind of got into the living the life mode.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have that extra motivation to do all those things that you need to do to be world class. But I graduated, and it was sort of like, oh my God, what do I do now? I was right in the middle of the Vietnam War. And so what I did, I decided to go to business school. And I got back into school in time to stay exempt from the draft. at University of Southern California.
Okay.
That's another chapter. Then I also dedicated myself to try to make the Olympic team. So I was getting my MBA and hopefully the Olympic team.
Were you training at USC?
Yeah.
You were? Okay.
Earl McCullough and O.J. Simpson, all those guys were my next-door neighbors.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that?
As we trained together.
Yeah. What was that environment like?
Well, it was certainly different than Stanford. I mean, they catered to the athletes down there pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we didn't buy much food for 2 years, for a good example, because O.J. Simpson's apartment was just down the alley about two houses from where I was, and he and Earl McCullough and a couple other guys lived in this apartment house, and once a week a truck or van would show up and go up and stock their refrigerator. And what they did then is they took everything that they hadn't eaten for the and gave it to us. So, I mean, there were some perks for sure.
Yeah. Did you find it difficult to balance graduate school with really training at that world-class level?
No, I didn't. Academically, it was so much easier for me at SC than at Stanford that it didn't interfere with anything. It just was. It's a different kind of an education. Not that it's not a good education, but it was one that. At Stanford, if you took a test on, and even if you were wrong with something, if you wrote a good reason why you thought it was that way, you could still get an A in the class.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at SC, if 2 + 2 = 4, you better have 4 down, not 3.9 or something else. I mean, because it was more of a fill in the blanks kind of thing rather than thinking.
Now, were most of your friends...
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Now, were most of your friends during that time elite athletes as well?
Probably not, no. I mean, a couple of them trained at Stanford and a couple of them trained at SC. You know, that were... had either graduated or gone to the school or something like that, and they became friends. But the guys I lived with and people I dated and things like that were just normal students.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you wouldn't mind just taking us through the Olympic trials process prior to the 68 games.
Well, they called it the pre-trials in Los Angeles, where they were going to take the top six, I believe, of every sport and take them up to Echo Summit to train, with the final selection being made at altitude, which the track at Echo Summit at South Lake Tahoe was within several feet of what the elevation was in Mexico City.
Wow.
Which was good planning on the U.S.'s part, because there were a number of athletes, that just particularly the black athletes, that were susceptible to sickle cell anemia and couldn't compete at that altitude.
So the altitude was a consideration even in the trials process?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very, very much so.
Did you?
The 100 and the 200 were questionable for oxygen deprivation, but that showed up in spades at the 400 meter level.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two or three of the athletes that were probably some of our better athletes in the 400 meters, for instance. There was a guy by the name of Kemp, who was probably the best one we had in the country, even in light of Lee Evans.
Mm-hmm.
He was certainly a threat to Lee Evans. He couldn't compete. He had a chance of dying, I guess. So, you know, everybody else trained at altitude and competed at altitude.
Yeah. Now, where did you place in your qualifier?
I was third.
Okay.
Carlos and Smith are 1 and 2.
And what was the reaction like back in your hometown when you did qualify?
I still got a pile of telegrams.
Do you really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big deal back in Montana. I mean, they get some people qualify once in a while in archery or shooting or horsemanship, that kind of thing, but not too often the major sports, they have somebody that competes and qualifies.
Mm-hmm.
The hometown was well received. They still are. I mean, I still go back, and if I run into the right people, they want to sit down and talk.
Yeah. Now, going back to altitude training, you had mentioned in the build-up to the trials, training at altitude. Was that the case post-trials as well, pre-Olympics?
Well, the final trials were just within a few days of... we packed up our suitcases, got on the airplane, went to Mexico City.
Oh, they were? Okay.
There was not much... There was probably 2 weeks, maybe.
Okay.
And that too, I think we probably spent probably, I don't remember exactly, but I probably a week before the first event, we were in Mexico City, and then we were there for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So some people were there as long as 3 weeks.
Wow. So just shifting gears a little bit, do you remember much about the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
Well, put it this way. If you look at the sprints, the 100, the 200, the 400, the high hurdles, the intermediate hurdles, that's 5 events. I was the only white guy.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard much about possible protests?
All kinds of rumors, yes.
Yeah.
You know, guys that were my friends suddenly became very icy to me. You know, and I'd walk up and they'd be chitter-chattering about something and they'd see me and they'd stop.
Is it something that you talked about, or... What were your thoughts and feelings at the time?
Not a whole lot, because I was uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I was thinking about things I didn't want to be thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was there to try and win a race, not to bring politics into the Olympic Games. And I still feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what the Olympic Games are about. It's not politics, it's competition. And
now, in addition to that, there were also student protests in Mexico City in the days before the start of the games.
Right.
And
about it.
Yeah.
I didn't witness anything like that.
You didn't.
I know they had, you know, pretty tight security, for instance, on the training facilities and where we lived, the housing and all that kind of stuff.
Now, did you live in the village?
Yep.
You did? Okay. And what were your impressions of the village and perhaps even Mexico City more broadly?
Well, I will tell you that the ride from the airport to the facility was an eye-awakening experience, because you go through some real poverty-stricken areas in Mexico City to make that trip.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, my God, people who actually live here and these things. Yeah, it was pretty eye-opening for a young buck from Montana.
Yeah.
To see something like that. But then you kind of, that square where they had the riots and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Two Comanias or something, it's called. It's beautiful. You know, so we saw the very rich and the very poor beside of Mexico City.
Yeah.
The facilities themselves, I thought they were just fine.
Mm-hmm. Did you get the opportunity to do a lot of sightseeing?
Well, I did some,
yeah.
But not till after my event.
Okay. And you mentioned the Olympic Village, staying there. Could you talk a bit more about what those accommodations were like? Who were you roomed with, things like that?
Was rooming with I don't think there were any, I hate to put it this way, but I think that they might have been segregated. Because I think about it, I roomed with, there were like four, if I'm correct, I think there was like a sitting room and four bedrooms that are all identical on each floor, and every one of us had a room in one of these clusters. And I don't remember who my roommates were, but I think they were, might have been John Pinnell and a couple other pole vaulters. They were, I'm pretty sure, all Caucasian descent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah.
I really don't remember that.
That's okay.
It obviously didn't bother me much because it didn't make much of a lasting impression.
Yeah. Now, did you have a chance to attend the opening ceremony?
Yes, I did.
Now, obviously, a very memorable experience for a lot of Olympians. What was that like for you?
Likewise.
Yeah.
I still cry when I watch the opening ceremonies and the closing ceremonies. It just boils out of me.
Are there any things that stick out particularly vivid?
No, not a single event or anything. Just the enormity of everything that, it was the beginning of, the opening, and it was the closing of, and in my case, it was the last race I was ever going to run.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just kind of it. I mean, I would just say the enormity of the project and to be there and be with all the world's best from all the countries of the world. It's huge.
Yeah. And moving forward into your event itself, what were you doing in the days just prior to it? Were there any special last-minute training sessions or preparations that you took part in?
Did you prepare for Mexico City?
While you were there, before your event actually took place, what were kind of your last...
It was just standard workout, as ritualistic as you could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
On this day you do these and you do this and you do that and you got whatever works for you and you do it.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want to change anything. I mean, because what you got you there. Minute modifications maybe to hopefully get another hundredth of a second or something. But that would be about it.
Sure.
Watching your diet pretty carefully.
Sure.
Because the food was different.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to get Montezuma's revenge.
Yeah. On that note, actually, what was the food like there?
I have no recollections of it to speak of. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was a big dining area right in the center of where these high-rise apartment buildings were built. You had just about anything you wanted. And I honestly think they were bringing the food in from the United States. I think we had our own food coming in every day.
Now, your event has obviously been very well publicized, but you have a pretty unique vantage point, having actually competed in it. So how did you feel about your performance and the outcome of the competition?
Well, I didn't like my performance. Two guys beat me that had never beaten me before. And I had a good lane, and I really felt like I was going to be able to do very well. And I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't run my best race. It wasn't my last one.
What did you do immediately after the event?
That I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
I honestly don't have a clue at all. I couldn't give you an answer.
You'd mentioned the lane as well. What lane was it specifically? Do you remember?
I had lane 5.
You had lane 5, okay.
That's about as good as it gets.
Yeah.
There were some interesting sidelights to all of this, but I don't know if you want to hear the smut.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them.
Well, have you heard anything about when the payoff for wearing shoes started?
I have not.
Well, that was covered in Sports Illustrated even.
Mm-hmm.
The Adidas and Puma and I don't know who else were involved with trying to get athletes to wear their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some money being pushed around under tables and stuff. And I didn't know much about it. And I took my shoes into the Adidas store. I had some work done on it between the... He ran the first two races one day, and then he ran the two on another day, the next day. Or there might have been a day in between a rest, but he ran two and two. But in between the races, I took my shoes in to get some work done on them. That's
uh-huh.
when they had removable spikes and that kind of stuff on shoes.
Sure.
And when I picked them up and I got them back to my room, I went to put my foot in the shoe, and it was full of money. All kinds of, $100 bills rolled up. Several thousand dollars. Well, it absolutely terrified me.
Yeah.
I gave it to Coach Jordan, told him what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know to this day whatever happened to that money. But then the publicity was covering this stuff. We became aware of the people getting thousands of dollars to wear their equipment.
Mm-hmm. Was this relatively unheard of at the time?
Oh, yeah. That was, you'd have been long gone Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not like it is today.
Yeah, sure.
it was a crime to take money, because it was an amateur competition.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things that was troubled me. And that happened between the semifinal and it happened to me between the semifinal and the final. That's when it happened. I was thinking more about I was going to get caught,
mm-hmm.
and I was focused on running the race.
Right.
So it was really it was too bad that happened, because I don't know how much it affected me, but I know it had some effect.
Is this something that was talked about a lot within athlete circles?
No, because everybody was, you know, everybody wanted to know if the other guy got more money than
sure.
he did.
Yeah.
You know, it was who was getting paid and how much were they getting? And you know, the numbers were anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000, and that's a lot of money.
Sure.
In
1968. Sure. So kind of turning to your relationship with some of your U.S. teammates, was there anyone that you were particularly close with during that time period?
Yeah, John Pinnell.
And could you just elaborate a little bit about your friendship? What sport did he compete in?
He was my roommate. He was a pole vaulter.
Okay.
He was my roommate at South Lake Tahoe.
Had you two known each other before then, or is that where you...
No, not really. We knew each other, but not what you'd say a friend or anything like that. Just an acquaintance.
Okay. Did you interact with athletes from other countries? You know, what was that experience like?
Very limited.
Limited?
Yeah, very limited. Yeah, I didn't want anything to do with them. I wanted to beat them.
Yeah. Were there any that you remembered from your travels abroad in college who made it to the 68 games?
Yeah, I had a couple of them. There was a girl by the name of Mary Rand that Bill Toomey ended up marrying. Not many guys. No, there were a couple of girls.
Yeah.
But that was a different purpose.
Yeah. So that, I guess that's a good segue into the topic of gender verification, which was introduced at the 68 games. Was that...
What?
Gender verification?
Gender verification.
Yeah, was that something that you were even aware of?
Well, I don't know what that means at all.
Yeah, that's... It's something I'm not sure if it received as much publicity then as it is now in the literature, but... Just an aside, I guess. How about interaction with athletes from the Soviet bloc or from East Germany?
Some of the people were, you know, we knew enough to get a hug and a hello to.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about it.
Yeah. You were more focused on just on the competition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, with regard to performance-enhancing substances, were you aware or did you receive the list of banned substances?
I'm sure we did, yes. But in those days, at least naive cowboy from Montana felt that was, most of that drug activity was limited to the guys that threw the shot put and the discus and the weight and strength kind of events,
mm-hmm.
rather than the sprinting and so on and so forth. I wasn't aware of that. I think that is probably about when it started, and to some significant amount was around that 68 period.
Yeah. Do you remember having any particular feelings about either the list or even drug testing?
Well, I didn't do it, so I wasn't worried about it.
Yeah.
That was probably naive on my part, if you look back at it in hindsight. Why wouldn't it make you stronger? Why wouldn't it make you do super ordinary things?
Mm-hmm.
I played the game honestly, and I hold my head high.
Sure.
I have nothing I have to be ashamed of.
Yeah. So it was essentially a non-issue then for you?
For me, it was a non-issue, yeah.
Now, we touched a little bit about some of the social issues surrounding the games. If we could talk a little bit about the Black Power Salute in more detail. Do you remember where you were when it happened?
I was sitting in the stands directly in front of the podium.
Were you really?
About 15 rows from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That way I can see my teammates get their medals.
Yeah. Were you alone, or was it you and other American athletes?
I think there was, I might have been with Pennell or somebody like that.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember. No, I was. I was with the other pole vaulter. It was Corey something. It was a young high school kid that made the team.
Uh-huh.
We went to see, specifically to see the award ceremony.
Yeah. And what was your reaction to that event?
I was sickened. That was a real dark brown spot, as far as I'm concerned, on the athletes, what they did.
Is that something that you discussed with those whom you were with?
Oh, I'm sure that I did, yeah. We probably all discussed it.
Yeah. Obviously, you got to know Smith and Carlos fairly well, since you all...
I know them better now than I did then.
Yeah. Have your thoughts about it changed in the years since?
I'll give you my opinion on this.
Yeah.
This is an opinion. You remember a little kid and you played this little game where you sat in a circle and you told a story and you whispered in the ear on one, and as he told the next story and you went around the circle, and when it came out the end again, it didn't sound like anything that happened, that really happened?
Sure.
That's exactly what, in my opinion, has happened. I mean, they've got all kinds of notoriety, and really, everyone was appalled at what they had done. If you were back in the early days after the Olympics, neither Tommy or Carlos could get jobs. The public was so upset with them. It's not because they were black, it's because they misrepresented the country. The Olympic Games is at the top tier
You could argue it, international sports, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you think about the highest level you could possibly negotiate anything on was at the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was, it was so wrong to do that. I've got to be careful where I say that these days. That story I told you is really what I believe happened. It's gone from something that was bad, ugly, and evil to something that was righteous. And I mean, I hadn't even thought about. I got another story to tell you. You get me going. I can tell you lots of stories. Was there prejudice in the country? I guess there was, but it certainly wasn't anything I've done. I trained with these guys. We joked and ate and partied some and everything else. They had to remind me that there was a difference for me to even consider it, which they did. This is a sidelight. I was the first alternate for the relay team, for the 4x100 relay team. Charlie Green got hurt, had a pulled hamstring. He led our team off. He had no business running. We had a team meeting with Stan Wright, Charlie Green, Jimmy Hines, Ronnie Ray Smith, and Mel Pender.
Mm-hmm.
And they voted with me in the little tented area we were sitting and talking to run black or not run at all. Which is basically took a gold medal right out of my hands. That's a story that's never been told.
And where was this decision made?
They made it out in the middle of the practice field. A meeting of six bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Me being in one of them.
Were there any coaches?
Yes, yeah, Stan Wright.
Yeah.
He was the black coach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a little hard feeling around that. And this is the first time I ever looked at those guys. I told them, I said, you know, when I got up and walked away, I turned around and walked away, I said, you know, I finally realized what it's like to be experience prejudice. Because you just demonstrated it in the most obvious form that you could possibly have done it. And to do it right in front of me. I mean, yeah. There were some...
When you...
going on.
Yeah. When you reconnected with some of these guys after the games, is this something that you ever discussed?
Nope. Never discussed it.
Okay.
Not that good of friends with them that, you know, they basically turned it into a way to make a living.
Changing topics a bit, do you remember much about the record-setting events at the games? Obviously, in track and field, there were quite a number of them.
I can tell you about Bob Beamon.
Yeah.
I was sitting directly, if you ran off the end of the runway and ran up into the stands, I was about 10 rows up there, looking at him. He was jumping right straight toward me on the field. And I remember when they posted the meters up there, and it was a predominantly English-speaking crowd around that area, and I could do, I knew that it was 29 feet, 4 inches, or much quicker than the average turkey break, because I just am good with numbers.
Mm.
And I did that conversion, I said, my God, he jumped 29 plus feet. Everybody looked at me and said, oh, like, no, 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 no. And then they posted it up, and here it was. It was 29, 4.5, I believe.
What was the reaction like in the section? I mean, I imagine it must have been...
Oh, yeah, the crowd went nuts.
Yeah. Were there any other memorable or interesting events that you wanted to share from those games?
Trying to think what it was. That was the one that was probably the most outstanding because, you know, if you look at percentage-wise, how much he beat the existing world record. I mean, just things like that don't happen very often.
Yeah, yeah. Did you get a chance to attend the closing ceremony?
I did.
You did? So tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, it was equal, or maybe more than equal to the opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I can just. The words that describe it are exactly the same as the opening ceremonies. I mean, it was just an awesome experience.
Yeah.
And you developed a camaraderie with a whole bunch of new people. And there was just a whole lot of hugging and squeezing going on.
Yeah.
It's a terrific experience. I mean, to be the best in the world, whatever it is you're doing, is really a, you know, it's a Super Bowl. It's an Indy 500 win. There's probably some little thing that I know there's lots of them. I just can't think of one now, but it's something that's not as well known.
Mm-hmm.
That has the same connotations to it.
Yeah.
I mean, not many people ever get to be experienced the being the best in the world at what they do, and get notarized for it.
Yeah. Now, in the post games period, what did you do right after the games finished?
I went back and went to work.
All right, and where was that?
I was hired by, I had a job before I even went to the games.
Mm-hmm.
I committed back in June prior to the trials and everything that I would go to work for IBM when I got done with this track and field thing.
Yeah.
Provided I didn't get drafted.
Now, did a lot of your colleagues, what was the support like in your work setting?
Oh, they thought it was really neat.
Yeah.
I went in with a big sales organization that IBM was at that time. A hot shit kid from the Olympic team, is you couldn't have a better candidate for your salesman.
Yeah.
And it worked out that way.
And the reaction back home, was it pretty similar?
Yeah, very much so.
So when did you start reducing your level of involvement in competition?
The finals or the Olympic Games?
That was it?
Done.
Was that something that you had determined beforehand? Yeah.
One athlete I can say I truly admired was a guy by the name of Sandy Koufax.
Uh-huh.
You remember how he quit?
How's that?
He won the Cy Young Award and quit.
Went out on top.
Amen.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to get any better. So why give these young bucks something to shoot at? Hell with this.
Did you stay involved in the sport in another capacity afterwards?
No.
No? Not as a coach or as a referee?
Not for many years. And then I did pick it up for a little while. I did some officiating for about 4 or 5 years. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's one piece of advice that you would give to an aspiring Olympic hopeful today? I know there are a lot that you could, but if there's one that stands out.
Follow your dreams. Do everything you can do to do that, I guess would be what I'd say.
And just kind of going into some broader significance here, what was the impact of the games on your life? How was it an experience that affected you throughout the future?
Well, I think it gave... it's funny. Right now, if you go on your computer and go to Google and type my name in, you're going to get something.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you probably should do that. If you haven't done it already for some other athletes. But just Google my name and see what you come up with.
Yeah.
I mean, this is 50 years ago. 40 years ago. What is it? 68, 32, 44. 44 years ago.
Yeah.
A long time.
Yeah, so it's very much that being a part of something that lasts almost.
It's, you know, I still have the Stanford sprint records. That's a long time ago for a big school like that, that they haven't had somebody that can sprint. I'm in a constant state of battle with the Montana High School Association, because they took my name out of the record books because they changed to meters rather than feet or yards.
Was this recent? A recent development?
Excuse me?
Was this a recent development?
No, it's been going. It went about, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, something like that.
No kidding.
They did conversion.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so wrong. They try and compare some new hotshot sprinter from the high school who can do this and do that. Not only did he not run as fast, but he lost. In my case, in high school, I never lost a race.
Yeah.
Two events for 2 years, for 3 years. Not one time did I lose.
Mm-hmm.
That deserves to be in the Montana High School record book.
And that was actually my final question, but I did want to leave it open if there was anything else that you wanted to share with us.
No, I don't know. I've probably said too much already.
Well, I did want to thank you again for your time. You know, we're always very glad with the generosity that's displayed by a lot of members of the 68 team, and we're certainly happy that you were willing to share with us some of your memories as well.
What are you going to do with this stuff?
So what we're planning to do is...